All right, we are still in 1 Samuel, series of kingly lessons, continuing to look at how God is working in the nation of Israel and in what ways that instructs us as to how God interacts with us. So we have our map up here. We're going to need to be looking at this a little bit this evening, and I know some of those names are a little bit convoluted up there as they all blend together. I'll try to point out the ones that are particular to us. 1 Samuel chapter 11. Now we looked at 1 Samuel 10 in going back farther to chapter 9. The people of Israel demand from Samuel a king. They want to be like all the other nations. The reasons they give, they want the king to fight their battles for them. And the Lord rebukes them for that because it is ultimately an expression of their rejection of God Himself. They don't feel like God is the one that is able to take care of their problems. And so they want a king just like the nations around them. It wasn't that there was necessarily anything wrong with a king per se, because we looked in Deuteronomy when Moses was giving the law, and God gave permission for the Israelites to select a king in Deuteronomy 17. But He gave some regulations on it, and when the people asked for a king, it wasn't the king that was a bad thing. It was their reason for asking for it that was a bad thing. You talk about trying to do right. And here's the problem with doing right. Okay? Is that number one, you have to do the right thing, you have to do it the right way, and you have to do it for the right reason. And if you throw off one of those three things, you suddenly have a wrong. Okay, the ethical mathematics, if there's a negative anywhere in there, it becomes wrong. If you do the right thing in the right way for the wrong reasons, in God's sight, it is accounted as a wrong, isn't it? As we approach our relationship with Him. If we do the wrong thing in the right way for the wrong... I don't know if you can do the wrong thing in the right way, but if you can do the wrong thing for the wrong, for the right reason, it's still wrong, isn't it? So... our motivation's important. The actions that we do are important. This is why God is constantly telling us not only to guard our hearts, but also to make sure that we're walking obediently. So it's not just one or the other. So if a person is sincere, their heart's in the right place, they've got good motivation, but they're doing the wrong thing, it's still wrong, isn't it? And this is where we get into a lot of ethical problems as we start talking about what's right and what's wrong. Especially when you get into contemporary issues like, say, homosexual marriage, you say, you want to accept them and love them, and they try to convince us that they're just loving people just like the rest of us, and that's supposed to make us sympathize with them, which we can in some degree, but it doesn't matter how much they just want to have a one-on-one loving relationship. Now, I would contest that anyway, because statistics don't point that out, but just let's accept for the basis of argument that premise. They just want to have a loving relationship. Okay, I accept. That's your motivation. But guess what? God still says that action is wrong. And so we can't go down that route. No matter how much we would, so quote-unquote, sympathize with your position, we can't go down that route because God says that's a wrong behavior. Even if the attitude's right. Now, then we can contest and say, well, the attitude's not right because there's other things wrong with that, but... just as that example, and Israel, as they are approaching this kingdom, trying to establish this kingdom, wanting to see the kingdom established in their nation, they're doing it from wrong motivations. Because they want the king to be their protector. They want the king to be their provider, to provide economic stability. They want the king to provide security. And that's what they're hoping will happen. When all throughout the law, God's constant call to the people of Israel is, I'm your provider, I'm your protector, I'm the one that gives you security, and if you don't find it in me, you're not going to find it anywhere. As we looked last week, we commit the same problem when we look to anything but God to be those things in our lives. How secure does a big bank account make you? It doesn't. That could be wiped away in a moment. How secure does good health make you? Not at all. Could be taken away in a moment. How secure can a house full of guns make you? Not at all. God is our protector. God is our provider. God is the one that gives us security and stability. And only in a right relationship with Him can we find those things. And if we look for it anywhere else, we're deceiving ourselves. And that's where Israel finds herself. Samuel rebukes them for it. He tells them they're off on the wrong motivation in chapter 10 when he calls the people together. But at the same time, God's purposes and plans for Israel are to establish a kingdom because He is going to set His Son as the king over them. It has always been God's purpose that His Son rule over the people of Israel. From the very beginning, from before the foundations of the world, God's purposes were to set His Son as the king over all the earth. And so this doesn't change God's plan. It's not an interruption to it, and it's not that they preempted it and asked for it before God was ready. And so God establishes the kingdom, and He anoints Saul, chooses Saul to be His king. And as we talked last week again about the distinction between divine sovereignty in the events of life and human responsibility, say Saul had everything he needed to do what was right, to be the king that God wanted him to be. And as we see, as we're going to see throughout this study, sometimes Saul is right on the money, and most often he's not. But there's going to come a king very soon that's going to fulfill all of God's purposes in Israel. A king that walks after God's own heart. But we're going to be introduced to him later, because before Israel can experience the blessings of the kingdom under God's appointed king, they need to experience the problems of appointing a king that isn't after his own heart. They need to see that the kingdom itself is not what saves them. It's not the political organization of the nation that's going to be their deliverance. And that's what they're going to learn under Saul, because he is going to be a failure in the terms of what God wants the king to be. That's going to start coming out. But first, in chapter 11, we're actually going to see that Saul is going to start off successfully. He's going to start off doing what the king should do. So we pick up in 1 Samuel 11, verse 1. Then Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, "Make a treaty with us, and we will serve you." But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, "On this condition I will make a treaty with you, that I gouge out all your right eyes, and thus bring disgrace on all Israel." So here's the situation. Jabesh Gilead, if you look at the map up there, is right about here. Can everybody see the hand moving and see which one Jabesh Gilead is? Okay, I know that's... Let me increase the font size here just a little bit so you can see Jabesh. How's that? Okay. Right there is Jabesh Gilead. It's west of the Jordan River by a few miles. So it is not in the area over here that we normally think of as Israel. It's here on the western side in the land of Gilead. This is a much more mountainous region of Israel, at least over here by the Jordan, but it does settle off into some nice plain land. If you remember when Israel came up from Egypt and they encamped, over here, three of the tribes realized this is really good land for pasturing flocks. As once you reach the mountainous sides on the west of Jordan, you get off into some nice plain lands on the plateau there. And it's great for pasturing flocks. And so several of the tribes said, "Hey, we want to live over here." And Moses granted that. They divided up that land. The trouble was that land was occupied when they got there, just like the rest of the promised land was. It was occupied by the Moabites and the Amorites and the Ammonites. Farther south, you have down here, the Moabites are down here in this southern region. The central area was occupied by the Amorites. Now, don't confuse the Amorites with the Ammonites. They're different people groups. The central area, where Jabesh-Gilead is, was occupied by the Amorites. And up north here, in this area, was the Ammonites. Now, that's important distinctions to make, because it's going to come into play. The Ammonites, Nahash, this guy from Ammon, comes from up here. And the dividing between these two nations are some little creeks or rivers that run from west to east and empty into the Jordan River. The Jabbok is one of them, the Arnon is another one. And those are sort of the separating boundaries between the Amorites and the Ammonites. So Nahash, the Ammonite, comes down from the north and attacks Jabesh-Gilead. Now, you just by looking at the terrain there, you can tell if the border of Ammon is up here by this brook that's right about there. You can see by going all the way down to Jabesh-Gilead, he's already well into Israelite territory. This invasion was not right on the borderlands. He has a deep penetration into Israelite territory, which means he's already conquered all the small towns and villages between the Ammonite border and Jabesh-Gilead. Jabesh-Gilead is a fairly large town. That's why he attacked it. Because if you can conquer the large town, then you own all the surrounding areas as well. And also, that's where all the men are going to be gathered. So if you are besieging a town, and this is what's going on here, you've got it surrounded by your army. And all of the troops of the place you're attacking are walled up inside that city. Cities typically, the major cities anyway, had very large, strong walls surrounding the entire city as a means of protection. And when an enemy was coming, you'd ring the town bell, you'd sound the alarm, and everybody that lived outside was supposed to come in, and that's where you could be protected and safe. And then you have all the men that were farming the land around the city, they're inside, they've got their weapons, they're able to man the walls and fight off any attacks. Well, one problem with defending your city that way is it's very easy to just wait. If the enemy encamps around the city and they control all the flow of food and water into that city, then all they have to do is sit there and starve you out. Because eventually, you're going to run out of food. And especially since you've called in all the people that used to live off the land outside the city, and now they're inside the city, there's not typically a whole lot of farmland inside cities. Okay, you might have some gardens and things, and the only water you're going to get is rain. And it doesn't rain all that much in this portion of Israel. And so it's not going to be long before your supplies start to dwindle. And you are looking at either starving or going out and fighting the enemy. Well, if the enemy has a much larger army than you do, your only hope is to stay inside and hope he eventually gets bored and leaves. Maybe he destroys everything around you, gets satisfied with that, and decides you've had enough and he goes home. That's really about your only tactic. Well, at this point, the men of Jabesh-Gilead are ready to say to Nahash, they've been in this siege long enough that they're willing to start talking terms. Because what's the message they send to Nahash? Make a treaty with us and we will serve you. So apparently they've been in this siege long enough, maybe the food supplies are running low, things are getting tight inside the city, or they have surveyed the situation, they've counted all their men, said, well, you know, we got 400 pretty good guys here, and Nahash out there has got several thousand. There's no way we can win this battle. There's no way we could go out and fight against them, and if we stay here, we're all going to starve to death. So it's better if we make our treaty with him, we surrender, at least he'll let us live, probably. You got to understand that warfare in the ancient world was not governed by any treaties. Okay? They didn't have, Geneva. They didn't have Geneva Conventions. They didn't have the national groups of nations getting together and saying, you know what, this kind of warfare really isn't fair, let's not do that. In fact, the best policy to win a war was a scorched earth policy. If you went into a nation and you really wanted to defeat them and make sure that they never attacked you again, you lined up all their men. You killed off every tenth one. This is where we get the term decimating. Deci means one tenth. You kill every tenth man. Or if you're really vehement about it, you kill every one of them. And you leave them not a single soul left to propagate an army, much less work the fields. And so if all the able-bodied men have been killed in the war, then there's nobody left to work the field, so the economic situation of that country is going to be very, very poor, and the military situation is going to be very, very poor, and the political situation is going to be very, very poor. That's how you kept nations from rising up against you. And so as they're staring down Nahash, they're saying, hey, let's make some terms with this guy. The worst that can happen is he kills us all, which he's going to do anyway. We're either going to starve to death here, or he's going to break into the city and he's going to kill us, or if we surrender to him, he probably won't kill everybody, he'll just kill some of us. So you start doing some mathematics and you say, well, it's not a great situation, but this is the best thing we can do. So they send a message to him, make a treaty with us and we will serve you. And Nahash's response in verse 2, but Nahash the Ammonite said to them, on this condition I will make a treaty with you, that I gouge out all your right eyes and thus bring disgrace on all Israel. So what he wants to do? Line up all the men that are in the city and poke out their right eye. Well, that's going to leave a population of men not very able to fight. It's hard to have a whole lot of depth perception with just the one eye. So you're not going to be as good of a fighter. You're not going to be as good of a worker. He doesn't want to kill everybody, so that's a bonus. But he does want to disgrace and humiliate everybody in Jabesh-Gilead and thence everybody in the nation of Israel, because it's going to be very, very evident with all these one-eyed guys walking around that Israel was defeated by her enemy. That's a humiliating thing. Now, why does he want to do that? Because if you go back into the book of Judges, in chapter 11, you read about a fellow named Jephthah. Jephthah. It's actually back in chapter 10, starting in verse 6. Judges chapter 10, verse 6. The people of Israel, again, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, there's a reason that the book of Judges constantly reiterates that phrase, because the book of Judges wants to show Israel why they kept falling into oppression, why they kept becoming enslaved by their enemies. It wasn't because they didn't have a king. It was because they kept disobeying God's covenant. Because God's covenant was very clear. You obey me, I'll bless you. Your enemies won't even want to attack you. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. Why were they serving the gods of the Ammonites? Well, because apparently they looked at the Ammonites and said, they're powerful, they're prosperous, we'd like to be like that. It must be because of their gods. And they display time and time again their lack of faith in Jehovah and what he is able to do and has promised to do for them. So they forsook the Lord, and they did not serve him. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hands of the Ammonites. Again, if you're looking at our map over here, the Philistines are down in this area. Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, Gath. This is all Philistine territory, even up to Aphek, along the coast. Okay, so they're sold into the hand of the Philistines from the east, and over here in the northwest section is the Ammonites. So they're getting hit from both sides now by their enemies because of their disobedience. Verse 8, they crushed and oppressed the people of Israel that year, and for 18 years they oppressed all the people of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in the land of the Ammonites. I remember where we said the Amorites were? This is the Amorite territory. Jabesh-Gilead is Amorite, or it used to be, until the Israelites defeated them all. Up here is the Ammonites, and here in the middle is the Amorites. Okay, so even in Judges, and this is about 100 years or so before Samuel, before the book of Samuel, they're being sold into the hand of the Ammonites. Verse 9, the Ammonites also crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed. So at this point in time, the Ammonites from up here have come down, they've conquered all of this area, and they're coming over across the Jordan down into Judah, which is down here. Benjamin is right above Judah, and Ephraim is right north of it. So all of this area is being attacked not only by the Ammonites from up here, but also by the Philistines from down here. So Israel is in a difficult, difficult spot. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against you because we've forsaken our God and have served the Baals. And from that point on, God sends Jephthah, who delivers Israel. Jephthah defeats the Ammonites in chapter 11 and sends them packing. He has a pretty good discussion that helps us place some of the timelines of the history of Israel with the king there. Basically, he says, hey, God gave us this land, you guys got to go. And then he fights against them, kicks them out, and the Ammonites are pushed back north into their territory. But now they've come down again. Probably he wants to humiliate Israel because of what Jephthah did to the Ammonites. Because Jephthah defeated the Ammonites, and the Ammonites felt slighted and embarrassed by that, he wants some revenge. So his treaty with the people of Jabesh-Gilead is, let me put out your right eye. You let me put out the right eye of every man in your city, and then I'll let you all live, and you can serve me. Well, they don't have a whole lot of choice. Verse 3, the elders of Jabesh said to him, give us 7 days respite, that we may send messengers through all the territory of Israel. Then, if there is no one to save us, we will give ourselves up to you. At this point, Saul's kingdom is not very firmly established. He's been anointed by the prophet Samuel. He's been selected publicly in the casting of lots. But Jabesh-Gilead, even at this point, doesn't recognize that Saul is the one that will be able to come deliver them. And so when they say, hey, give us 7 days, we're going to send throughout all the nation of Israel and see if anybody will come to help us. They don't specifically point out Saul as the king. And we're going to see a little bit later on, too, that Saul is not acting in the role of a king because the kingdom hasn't been firmly established in his hand yet. But this event is what's going to help Saul establish that kingdom. Okay? So they give us 7 days respite. We'll send out our messengers. And if no one will come to save us, we will give ourselves up to you. Now, I don't know about the military strategy of saying, okay, I'll wait 7 days to see if you can bring reinforcements. Generally speaking, you'd say, no, we'll just go ahead and conquer you now if you're in that desperate of a situation. But I guess there's honor even among thieves, right? So he says, okay, if you can find reinforcements, you can bring them in, then we'll have a nice fight. Either Nahash doesn't believe that they're going to find anybody, or he believes that it'll be a greater battle for him to win. If they can bring in some reinforcements, then we can defeat Israel all at once, and that'll be great. I'm not sure what he's thinking here. But when the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, they reported the matter in the ears of the people, and all the people wept aloud. Now, Gibeah is going to be a little harder for us to see because there are so many names. I wish this map program would let me pick out one. Gibeah. Let's zoom in a little bit, and we'll see if we can't find it. Right there. You see this one's kind of sandwiched there between Nob and Geba? Right here where the hand is. That's Gibeah. Okay. Saul lives in the tribe of Benjamin, which is just north of Jerusalem. Benjamin occupied this area right around here, and right there is Gibeah of Saul. So the messengers come from Jabesh-Gilead. They're scattered all throughout Israel looking for help, and one of them happens to come to Gibeah of Saul, which is where Saul was living at the time. Now behold, verse 5, here's an interesting statement. Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen. I said, wait a second. What happened last chapter? Saul was crowned king. What in the world is he doing plowing? That's where we say, okay, the kingdom is such a new thing in Israel. There is no governmental body established. There's no cabinet. There's no palace for him to live in. Those things haven't been created yet. So Saul naturally goes back where he goes back home after he's crowned king. Because up till this point, there hasn't been anything for him to do. This has not been a great length of time, and that's going to come out next chapter, when Samuel is giving his farewell address to the people of Israel. He points out that the coronation of Saul and the invasion of Nahash were very closely time-related events. Okay. So it's not like it has been years and years since Saul was crowned. It's been maybe days, maybe a few weeks. It has not been a long time. So if you remember back when Samuel anointed Saul, he gave him some instructions and said, you're going to go, you're going to meet the people that say your donkey has been found. Then you're going to keep going and you're going to find men going up to Bethel to worship and they're going to give you a present. Then you're going to go and you're going to join the prophets. Then you're going to come and meet me at Gilgal. And after that, do what your hand finds to do, for the Lord is with you. Whatever it is you find to do, whatever you think is prudent, you're the king, you're going to make that decision, you do it. After the coronation, what he found to do was, well, I don't know what else to do. I'm going to go back home and plow the fields because it needs done. That's actually a pretty good trait. I don't think that we find Saul here shirking his duty because there just hasn't been much duty. The kingdom isn't established. There's nobody to report to. There's no officers to get into place. There's nothing for him to do. So in the absence of knowing exactly what to do, he does what he knows to do. And this is great advice when you're wrestling with, what's my next step? What's my next major step in life? You say, maybe I don't know whether, you know, what my next step in my business is, or with my home, or where am I going to live? And if you're wrestling with some kind of major, major decision like that, and you don't know, the Lord hasn't clearly laid out in front of you yet what it is you're supposed to do next. And I'm talking about these big decisions, okay? With the big decisions, you're not sure. The thing to do is, do what you know to do. You still have to get up in the morning, right? You still have to make your bed. You still got to get dressed. You still got to eat breakfast. So you keep doing the things that you know you're supposed to do. How are you going to serve the Lord today? Well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do about the house. Do I need to sell it? I don't know what I'm supposed to do about this. Talk to younger people and say, I don't know if I'm supposed to go to this college, or who I'm supposed to marry, or what my career is supposed to be. Say, don't worry about that. You're thinking too big. What are you supposed to do today? Say, well, it's Sunday. What are you supposed to do? I'm supposed to go to church. Then you do that. You keep doing what you know God wants you to do, and He will direct your steps. Do you really believe that Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 is true? That if I trust in the Lord with all my heart, and I don't lean on my own understanding, but in all my ways acknowledge Him, that's the do what you know you're supposed to do part. In all my ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths. So if I do what He has clearly commanded me to do, am I supposed to love my wife today? No question about that, right? Am I supposed to raise my children, the nurture and admonition of the Lord today? No question about that. Am I supposed to spend time today reading God's Word and praying to Him? There's no question about that. I do the things there's no question about, and I trust that God's going to direct my future steps. Tomorrow will be made clear when I need it. Because if God hasn't made my next big step clear, it's because I don't need to have it clear yet. And we don't like that. We like to have everything laid out and neat and orderly. But God wants us to trust Him. And so Saul, I think, here at this point, is expressing a trust in God. He doesn't know what the next major step is. He doesn't know, as king, what he's supposed to do to help Israel in a tangible way, so he does what he knows he's supposed to do. The fields need plowed. So he went back home, and he's plowing the fields. So Saul comes from plowing the field behind the oxen, and he says, "What's wrong with the people? They're all weeping." So he comes in, he's got his dirty hands, he's probably got his calloused and sore fingers from holding on to the reins and everything. Hey, what's everybody standing around crying for? Now, this type of crying, we're not used to this in our Midwestern American mindset. We're a lot more reserved of a people than the Eastern people are, because when they cry, it is loud. If a whole town were gathered together and weeping, you would hear it from miles away. It's loud, it's expressive. Sometimes they throw dirt in the air, sometimes they tear their clothes. It is extremely, extremely expressive. And so Saul comes, and it's not just that everyone's standing around dabbing their cheeks with their handkerchief. This is loud wailing going on. Why is everybody so sad? What's wrong with the people that they're weeping? So they told him the news of the men of Jabesh. And here's where Saul finally says, "All right, I've done what I'm known supposed to do. Now God has completely opened the door in front of me. I see clearly exactly what He wants me to do next. There's the need. Jabesh Gilead is in trouble. They need a deliverer. I've been anointed. I've been chosen by the lot. That's me. That's my job." In verse 6, the Spirit of God rushed upon Saul when he heard these words, and his anger was greatly kindled. We talked this morning in Sunday school about righteous indignation. Here it is. The people of Israel are being oppressed by an enemy. This is exactly the opportunity for the king of Israel to show righteous indignation. No way are you going to humiliate my people. God's people are not going to fall before this enemy, not if we're walking obediently. So he is roused. The Spirit of God empowers him. His anger is kindled. Verse 7, he takes a yoke of oxen, cuts them in pieces, and sends them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers. Now this is a very symbolic act. Because number one, what are you going to plow the fields with now? It'd be like disassembling your car and sending pieces of it to everybody. to try and send a message. It's a vehement way to send a message. And not only is it symbolic that Saul is sort of burning the bridge behind him and saying, all right, I'm done plowing fields. God's called me on to something else now. From here on out, it's going to be this, fighting Israel's battles the way a king is supposed to. So he burns that bridge behind him, but he also sends this message because here's the imagery of this chopped up oxen. Whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. So the letter arrives in the mail. The UPS guy hands you this box, and you open it up, and there's an ox head in it. And you read the letter, and it's Saul's official. Uncle Sam wants you. Uncle Saul, we should say, right? Still U.S. Uncle Saul wants you, and the picture's there pointing at you. Right? You're being called up for military duty. This is basically a draft. Every able-bodied man was supposed to pick up a weapon and come. And if you didn't, right here in front of you is a symbol of the consequences. If you don't come out for this draft, Saul will come after you and cut up your oxen, if you have any. Okay? He's going to destroy your means of livelihood. He's going to render you poor in Israel because you're not going to have a way to plow your fields. So shall it be done to whoever does not come out after Saul. Now notice here that he doesn't just say, after me. Who else does he add to this list? Samuel. Because Saul recognizes that the authority of the king is still a very fragile thing. He hasn't done anything that have made the people rally around him, per se. Everybody still, in their heart, follows Samuel because he's the one that's been leading the nation for over 60 years. So I think he knows the hearts of the people are still with Samuel, even though they've all professed that he's the king. And so he's acknowledging that. So shall it be done to his oxen. Then the dread of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out as one man. Here you see this magnificent display of the unity of the people as they all fall in line and come to Saul to help. Now that dread of the Lord is... it's a two-way street. It really works as a fear of the consequences of not obeying this call, and also just that fear of the power of God and what He's going to accomplish here very soon. That fear of God works both ways. And so they all come out. Verse 8, when he mustered them at Bezek, the people of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah, 30,000. We see even here, before the kingdom begins, there's already a little bit of a rift between the northern tribe and Judah. Okay. That rift has been developing ever since they settled in the land, and it's going to continue even to the split of the kingdom. But we see it already happening there. Israel by far is supplying the bulk of the army here, 300,000 men, and Judah is supplying 30,000. So you've got a total army of 330,000. That's a pretty good size army, especially in these days. And so they come out from every little village in the area, and they gather together at Bezek, and he musters them. In verse 9, they said to the messengers who had come, thus shall you say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance. Now, how long had Jabesh-Gilead given Nahash? 7 days. So how long has it taken to notify Saul and muster the army? It's been like 6 days now. Tomorrow, we'll be there. Before your time is up, before the sun is hot. So we're going to get there in time to rescue you. So they are all gathered together at Bezek up here. And of course they gathered here because it's fairly close to Jabesh-Gilead. And it's not that far of a trip. I have this fun little tool on here, this ruler. Watch this. If we can find out where Bezek is, and we'll just trace a line and... Can you see down there at the bottom? It says distance on the bottom bar. Travel time. It says 5.7 hours, anywhere from 5.5 hours to about 10 hours. So you're an army marching, you're not going to move as quickly, but you've got about an 8 to 10 hour march from Bezek to Jabesh-Gilead. So if they're going to get there before the sun is hot, and we're going to find out here in just a few minutes that they're actually going to get there earlier than that. So they leave the night before. So serious is the situation that this army is going to march all night long to get to the battle. Right? Thus you shall say, but tomorrow by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance. And when the messengers came and told the men of Jabesh, what's their response? They're glad. This is kind of one of those understatements. Say, well, hey, we get to keep our eyeballs in our heads. Isn't that a good thing? Okay. They're glad. Obviously, they're glad. Therefore, the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will give ourselves up to you. We'll give ourselves up tomorrow. So they notify Nahash, okay, our 7 days is almost up. We'll give ourselves up tomorrow. All the time knowing, Saul said he's going to be here. Watch this. Nahash, we're tricking him. We're deceiving him a little bit. Tomorrow you may do whatever seems good to you. Which, of course, he's already told them what seems good to him. Verse 11, the next day, Saul put the people in three companies. And they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch. The morning watch was any time between 6 a.m. and 9 a.m. So this is fairly early. Okay, so it's the watch that would happen when the sun came up. So you're pretty early in the morning. He gets there. And they come into the camp in the morning watch, and they struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Heat of the day is, you know, the 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. So you've got a battle that lasts about a half a day here. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. That's a pretty effective rout. That's a pretty effective defeat, to scatter your enemies like that. And here it is again, because Saul was walking in obedience and the people of Israel were walking in obedience to God's commands, and he delivered them. Verse 12, then the people said to Samuel, and they hear about it, this victory. Now their hearts are starting to knit to Saul the king. Okay, it's not just a theoretical thing. He's not a newly elected leader. He's now done something for the nation. Think about the way the support levels of our president went way, way up right after 9/11. Okay. Why? Because he was acting on behalf of our country and everybody knew it. Okay. And so the support levels go up. Okay. When we see a president that isn't acting on behalf of our country, you start to watch the support levels go down. So the support levels, the polling here would have indicated that he had a pretty high approval rating right after this battle. All right. I don't know if they did Gallup daily tracking polls for Saul back then, but it probably would have been a pretty good number. Because they say to Samuel, who is it that said, shall Saul reign over us? You remember that back at the end of chapter 10? Right after Saul was chosen by the lot, there were some people that said, oh, this guy's not going to be able to do it. And it says they didn't bring him a present. They didn't bring him any kind of a gift for his inauguration. Now the people are starting to get so riled up that they're going to start trying to unleash some vengeance on anybody that didn't agree with them. Bring those men that we may put them to death. By the way, you didn't have freedom of speech back in the ancient world. You were not allowed to talk against your king. Here's the result of it. Here's what people would do. You talk against the king, that could mean death. And so you didn't. Because it could be construed as a coup. And so they want to bring everybody to death. But here we're going to see another characteristic of Saul. Not only was he trusting the Lord and doing what he was supposed to be doing at the right time, early in his kingdom, we also see he's, in the beginning, he's a man of grace. Because look at how he handles this. Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for the Lord has worked salvation in Israel. This is a day of rejoicing. This is a day of celebrating God's great deliverance. We're not going to mar that by executing people today. I mean, what a gracious response. He had all the authority. He had the backing of the people. He could have put these men to death. He had just cause for it, but he's not going to. So Saul demonstrates to us that he is a man of grace in the beginning of his reign. So then Samuel said to the people, come, let us go to Gilgal and there renew the kingdom. Now that you've seen what a godly king is going to do for you, it's time to renew this agreement. It's time to revisit this. Again, it hasn't been long, but it's time to set this in the people's minds. And so they go down here to Gilgal. And Gilgal's got a nice question mark because we're not entirely sure where it's at. But if you'll notice, he says, let us go to Gilgal and there renew the kingdom. So all the people went to Gilgal and there they made Saul king before the Lord. That little phrase, before the Lord, is always indicative that the tabernacle was in that place. Because the tabernacle was where God dwelt in Israel, right? So, where was the last place we saw this tabernacle? It wasn't in Judah, no. Yeah, it was here in Shiloh. You remember way back in the beginning of 1 Samuel, they were in Shiloh, and they took the ark from Shiloh, and the Philistines were gathering at Aphek, and that's where the ark was captured. So apparently they have moved the tabernacle from Shiloh to Gilgal at some point. Now the ark is still down in Kiriath Jearim. Hasn't moved yet. It's going to remain there for quite a while. But at this point, the tabernacle has been moved to Gilgal. So there in the presence of God, they went there. They have an official coronation ceremony. They make Saul king. There they sacrifice peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Here you've got the beginnings of the kingdom finally getting established, and it's starting off on the right note. Saul has shown himself to be a man of courage. He's shown himself to be a man of faith. He's showing himself to be a man of grace, and he's showing himself to be a man who is concerned about doing what's right. He offers those sacrifices. If only it would last longer. Because chapter 12, we're going to have Samuel's farewell address that we'll look at. And it's in chapter 13, just a little bit later, that Saul's going to start down this path of disobedience that's just going to keep spiraling out of control. But in the beginning here, Saul has all the promise of a man that's going to be a man after God's own heart. He waits upon the Lord. He doesn't have all the answers right off the bat, but that's not necessarily the mark of good leadership, is it? The mark of good leadership is going to be waiting on the Lord and letting Him direct. He needed something to establish the kingdom, and God provided it. He provided this battle where Saul was able to defeat his enemies and at the same time display to all the people that he was the man to do the job, at least in the beginning. And so our kingly lesson is the lesson that Saul demonstrated for us there in the beginning of the chapter, and that is, when you don't know what to do, just do what God plainly commands you and trust Him to lead your steps. And it seems like a simple little thing. That really is probably the heart and soul of walking with the Lord, isn't it? Saying, I don't have to come up with all the answers. God can take care of these things. I don't have to feel like I'm prepared for every contingency in my life. There's a big rise of what's called preppers these days. They're fearing a big economic disaster, and so you store up all kinds of dried food in your basement and bottled water and make sure you have cash laying around in case, batteries and all sorts of stuff, just in case. So you know what? Do we have to prepare for every just in case? Can you prepare for every just in case? No, we absolutely cannot. And there are some things that the Scriptures call us to do in preparedness. But for the most part, we're not supposed to worry about what we put on. We're not supposed to worry about what we're going to eat. We're not supposed to worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow can take care of itself. I'm supposed to do what I know I'm supposed to do today. And Saul gives us a good example of that. So let's go ahead and close our time in prayer this evening, and then we'll let you go and apply these things out in your lives day to day.